"Miki?" asked Dorothy as she, Kate, and Miki walked the few blocks down College to the corner with Bathurst and Sneaky D's.
"Yes?" said Miki.
"Are you a Dantrovian in training?" Miki blinked as though the question had taken him by surprise, and considered the answer for a moment. "I guess I am, sort of," he said. "I'm not really a convert, because I never really had a religion to convert from. But the animist aspects of Ezzelin's faith have intrigued me to the point where I've asked her to teach me about it, beyond simple involvement and a few observances. I suppose that does make me some sort of apprentice." He gave her a curious look. "Why?"
"No reason," she replied. "Curiosity. It's obvious that you're involved with her. I simply wondered on what level or levels."
Miki gave that a moment's thought as well, then replied, "That's one of the things I'm supposed to be considering this week, I think." The Toronto Ice Arena was packed. It was almost always packed. The 2404-2405 Maple Leafs were good, the best team the city had seen in years. They were a lock for the playoffs. The only question was how much farther they could go toward a record win-loss tie record, and the Leafs' faithful were turning out in droves to find out. Roy Chernov was one of those faithful, and liked to tell people that he had been so since before he was born. He held season ticket number 130, seat 1, row 10, section 118, right behind the Leafs' bench. He was especially looking forward to tonight's game, had been ever since the first month of the season, when it became obvious that the Leafs might have what it would take to go all the way. Their opponents tonight, the Ottawa Senators, were a prospective playoff match. This game might be a taste of round 1 2 months early. Roy settled into his seat, plugged his beer into the cup holder in the armrest, and greeted his friends and acquaintances in neighboring seats. You don't hold season tickets at a sporting venue without getting to know the people who sit around you, after all. He wondered if Jack Mayer was going to make it tonight. His wife Athena had gotten stricter with him since the birth of their son, which, Roy reflected with a grin, was as it should be. But still, it'd be a shame if Jack had to miss this game. Presently, a couple of young people came to the end of his row, consulting the ticket stubs in their hands, and excuse-me'd their way past Roy's knees into the row. They surprised him a little, he didn't recognize them, and surprised them a little more by taking the seats right next to him, Jack's seats. Intrigued, but not overly alarmed, Roy cocked an eyebrow and checked them out. They were kids, high school age, probably, a boy and a girl. Human, white, good-looking. She slim and athletic, with long, slightly feathery pink hair and laughing blue eyes. He tall and sturdy-looking, with a mane of wavy green and a slightly ascetic-looking face. He was dressed in a dark blue-ribbed turtleneck sweater and jeans, she in red Martian army pants, and a black jacket that looked like part of a uniform. He carried a box of popcorn and a cardboard tray containing 2 cups of soda, she a pair of hot dogs with everything. Now that Roy took a closer look, he decided the guy might be in college. He looked a couple of years older than his companion. They were running a little late. They'd hardly taken their seats and gotten settled when the player introduction started, giving Roy no chance to strike up a conversation. It was clear from their behavior that they didn't know either team particularly. They applauded for all the players, which was the polite thing to do, but didn't have any special favorites to cheer on either side. Not so Roy Chernov. He got to his feet and cheered his heart out for the entrance of the home team. His efforts doubled at the appearance of their last player, an absurdly tall and lanky man in heavy armor, whose sweater bore the number 38 and, apparently, the name Target.
"And tending goal for the Maple Leafs tonight," cried the PA announcer. "Number 38, René Philippe Target."
René Philippe Target settled himself in front of his goal, raking back and forth on his skates to scuff up the crease, whacking his stick against the ice. He looked a little ridiculous. The man had to be nearly 7 feet tall, and his limbs were so long and thin, even in his goaltender's armor, that he seemed almost like a stick figure. He had to hunch down until he almost resembled a folding chair, just to get his head below the crossbeam of the net, leaving enormous gaps to his left and right. The girl with pink hair leaned over to say something to her male companion, who chuckled. Roy guessed she was commenting on Target's wiriness, and how much open net it left behind him. He smiled to himself. She was in for a surprise when the puck started coming the Target's way. He stayed on his feet after cheering Target's entrance, since the next thing on the agenda was the national anthem. Roy noted with approval that the two kids from out of town, they had to be, who lived in Toronto with even a vague interest in hockey and didn't know about René-Philippe Target, got up and stood respectfully during O Canada, even though it probably wasn't their anthem. When the Leafs played teams from outside Canada, the visiting fans weren't always so respectful, and Roy always appreciated it when somebody was. Demetrios didn't seem to recognize Caitlin and her companions at first sight of them. Only when he noticed Dorothy did he seem to clue in, at which point he looked absolutely delighted and beckoned them over to the bar.
"Good, good, you came," he said. "I told Joe you might. He's looking forward to meeting you."
Kate reddened a trifle under her face powder.
"Me?"
she replied. Demetrios grinned.
"He was here for your show last year," he told her. "He had to leave partway through the show, and he's been pestering me to get you back here ever since."
Kate looked as if she didn't know how to take that.
Really?
She said.
"Well,
Here he comes now," said Demetrios, pointing to the stage. Indeed, several people were taking the stage. All of them were human, all college age, two men and two women. One of the women, the one with the bass guitar, was tall and whipcord thin, with skin the color of milk tea and a mass of orangey-yellow dreadlocks. The other was the drummer, a bit shorter and considerably stockier, with a swimmer's build of broad shoulders and narrow hips, a decent tan for Toronto in winter, and a shock of black hair that stood up like wire. The men were both guitarists, and both of about average build, one left-handed and blonde, one right-handed and bald as a cue ball. This one, who went to the microphone at center stage, was wearing wraparound shades that went with his wardrobe of black leather and electrical tape, and the gleaming chrome ports of a neuroprocessor on his shaven head to give him more than a little of the techno-outlaw look. This was Joe. Kate was surprised anew when this intimidating figure stepped up to the microphone and said, in a soft, mellow, friendly voice,
"Good evening, Sneaky D's. How are we all doing tonight?"
Applause and cheers rolled up to the stage from the packed room. Joe smiled, one gold tooth gleaming in the stage lights.
"That's great," he said. "We're happy to be here tonight. We're called the Crush of Love, and we call this one the Remorseless Advance of Centuries. My name's Joe."
Just as the sound of his name died away, without a drummer's count or any other preamble, the four of them touched their instruments, and a song began, possessed of a hard, mechanistic, percussive rhythm under a soaring, almost tortured-sounding guitar line. Caitlin was impressed. So was Miki. It wasn't really his sort of music, but the band members had artistry, and the discipline that opening showed didn't escape him either. He paid attention to the song itself, and began to realize as it progressed that it had musical depth not obvious at first blush, complexities hidden behind the starkness of its basic theme. He glanced at Kate, saw that she was hearing it too, and smiled. They moved a little deeper into the crowd and began to dance. Dorothy watched them go, at a bit of a loss, until she felt a touch at her elbow, and turned to see a young man in jeans and a Royal Ontario Museum t-shirt smiling at her.
"Would you like to dance?" he shouted through the roar of the band.
"All right," Dorothy replied.
10 minutes into the first period, it was obvious to Roy Chernov's considerable amusement that the two kids in Jack Mayer's seats didn't know the first thing about ice hockey. Well, no, scratch that. The girls seemed to know the first thing, just none of the other things. They reacted with puzzlement to icing calls, spent a few minutes figuring out the reasons for various penalty calls to their satisfaction, and were utterly mystified by the concept of the delayed penalty. Finally, as the referee and linesman were conferring at center ice to sort out a particularly weird penalty situation, he leaned over and touched the girl's arm.
"Excuse me," he said. "I couldn't help noticing. You kids seem to be a little lost. Anything you want to know, you ask me. I've been around this game all my life. Name's Roy Chernov."
He stuck out his hand, grinning. The girl reacted with neither suspicion nor hauteur, earning her a few more points in Roy's book. She just grinned back, shook his hand, and said, "Lieutenant Tenjo," adding, "He's Kyoichi Sayonji," with a cocked thumb at her companion. Roy wondered about that for just a second or so. They were obviously pretty good friends, these two, but they didn't act like boyfriend and girlfriend, and he'd just about pegged them for brother and sister before this. Oh well. None of his business, really. "You want to help us out," Utena went on. "You could explain what the heck that business with the blue line was about."
"Oh, that's an easy one," Roy said. "They were offsides."
"So where are you from?" The young man in the Royal Ontario Museum shirt asked Dorothy as they danced to a fast-paced, energetic, but at the same time rather haunting piece Joe called Blood Races, Time Stands Still. New Avalon, Dorothy replied, having decided that it was far too much work to explain that she was originally from Kane's world, and anyway, that wasn't what anybody was really looking for when they asked that question.
Cool, he replied. I'm Jay, by the way.
Dorothy, said Dorothy, who had somehow found a way to speak loud enough to make her thoughts communicable without actually breaking her impassive attitude by shouting like everyone else had to. Jay seemed to like that for some reason. At least, every time she answered him, he smiled a little wider.
You're very pretty, Dorothy,
he yelled. Thank you, she replied, though she didn't seem too impressed. Being impressed wouldn't have gone with the outfit, even if it had been the kind of thing she did often. Across the floor, Miki Kaoru was starting to enjoy this ridiculous get-up Kate and Dorothy had foisted on him. For one thing, the light unbuttoned shirt meant that he was quite cool, even though the room was hot and he was wearing a velvet jacket. For another, the girls kept wanting to touch the jacket. Or the pants. He didn't quite know how to react to the latter, but the former was certainly okay. The phenomenon seemed to amuse Caitlin considerably. There was a time, not too long ago, that he would have been either mortified or frightened stiff to be in a situation like this. A time when speaking to or being touched by any girl, even one he knew well, would have left him too flustered to function. He wasn't exactly a party animal these days, but Azelin de Vere Natoshkin had at least cured him of that most extreme form of his withdrawn and reserved nature. The costume and makeup helped with the rest. It was as if he'd put on a mask and become somebody else, except that he was still who he'd always been. He just felt freer to do, freer to be. He wasn't constantly looking over his shoulder, trying to live up to his grades, his reputation, his responsibilities as a counselor and a duelist. He was just a young man out having a good time with a couple of friends in a city full of friendly strangers. He grinned through his somber makeup at Caitlin, made his way close to her again, and cried,
"This band is quite good. Are you having fun?"
Yes, Kate replied, smiling.
Are you? You bet.
Oh, so you're friends of Dimitrios, said Roy Chernov during the first intermission. Well, sort of, said Utina. My roommate's band played at his place last fall, and he was really impressed, so when we stopped by and asked if he knew where we could get tickets to this game... Roy nodded, smiling. He called up Jack and pried tonight's tickets out of him. He said, "Yeah, that's Dimitrios. That's why I didn't get too excited when you showed up and weren't Jack and Athena. Dimitrios does that once or twice a month for somebody or another. Friends in from out of town, regular customers who need a lift, that sort of thing." "We really appreciate all your help," Utina told him. "I'd seen a couple of games on TV, but never really understood it, and Sionji here had never seen hockey before in his life. We're from the Outer Rim," she added. "Ah," said Roy knowingly. "So you missed out on a Galaxy's Greatest Game when you were kids. Shame, shame. Well, you're here now, though, right? Making up for lost time." He grinned. "Indeed," said Sionji. "I apologize for taking your concentration away from the game to answer my questions. My ignorance is detracting from your game." Roy made a dismissive gesture. "Bah," he said. "I'm happy to help. See, the way I figure it, we were meant to meet like this tonight. Huh? You come to town, you decide to come to the game on the spur of the moment, your friend knows Dimitrios, Dimitrios gets you tickets, you end up sitting next to me. I've been a Maple Leafs fan for 36 years. Nothing about this game or the team I can't answer. It's fate, I tell you." Sionji pondered this, then nodded. "That's one way to interpret it," he allowed, sounding slightly dubious. "In that case, can you go over the two-line pass again? I understand the mechanic of the rule, but not what its point is." "Hmm," said Utina, nodding. "What is up with that?" "Well, they don't use that rule in a lot of leagues," said Roy, "so there's kind of a debate about what the point is, but..." The more the Crush of Love played, the closer to the stage Caitlin got, and the more engrossed in their music. Her body kept dancing, smiling, and maneuvering through the other dancers with the grace and balance of a martial artist. Her Zanshin kept scanning the crowd for potential trouble. But her mind and heart were all occupied with the observation of the band, their performance, and their music. One thing she noted almost immediately was that Joe looked at the audience a lot more than she did. Normally, when she wasn't focused on her keyboards, Kate was looking at another member of her band,
usually as Lynn or Amanda, or at the back of the room. She didn't sweep the crowd with her eyes very often, and almost never looked at individual listeners. Joe, on the other hand, was constantly doing both, having doffed his sunglasses early in the set. He had very pale blue eyes that gleamed under the lights, and as he plied his axe, they constantly darted from person to person, as if he were determined to make eye contact with everybody in the audience at least once. Kate found the habit intriguing, but a little disturbing. She glanced to her right and had to laugh, silently, under the rolling torrent of a Crush song called Tsunami Overdrive. Mickey had been buttonholed by a group of what looked like fellow high schoolers, mostly girls and a couple of guys, over by the far wall. He was handling them with such aplomb, whatever they were talking about, that it almost looked as if he were holding court. Kate wished she could get a picture. She looked to the left, trying to find Dorothy, but the robot girl was nowhere to be found. The song crashed to an end, the applause burst out, and Joe wiped some sweat from his gleaming pate and said into the mic, "Phew! We're going to have to take a little break after that one. We'll be back up here in about 15 minutes. Till then, peace." Kate made her way to the bar and found an open space. Demetrios grinned at her and got her a Coke. A few moments later, Mickey managed to disengage himself from his admirers and wedge himself in next to her. "You seem to have quite a court going there," she observed with a smile. Mickey rolled his eyes good-naturedly. "They can't believe it's my natural hair color," he said. Then he pinkened a little under his makeup and added, "A couple of them say they want proof." Caitlin snickered a little. "Is today a holiday?" she asked with an impish smile. "Not that sort of holiday," Mickey replied. "Besides, as Lynn warned me about Canada." The person on Kate's right got up and swam back into the crowd. A moment later, he was replaced by a black-clad presence who said softly, "Excuse me." Kate turned and blinked. It was Joe, and he was talking to her. This close, she was a little startled to realize that his pale blue eyes weren't natural. They were Icon 3 cyber optics, their irises made of nearly transparent refractory crystal. "You're Kate Hutchins, aren't you?" Joe asked in his soft, mellow voice. "Leader of the Art of Noise, from Worcester." That's me, Kate replied. I'm sorry, but... Joe grinned a little shyly and took a drink of the beer Demetrios put down in front of him. "That's okay," he said. "Demetrios warned me." "Listen, kick ass, man," somebody said, slapping Joe on one leather-clad shoulder as he passed. "Thanks," said Joe with a nod and a smile. "Anyway," he said, readdressing Kate, "I just wanted to say that I thought you guys were really good when you were here last fall. I had to work, so I couldn't stay for the whole show, but you blew me away with that opener, and then just went up from there. I wish I could sing like you do." You have a nice voice, Kate managed, nodding encouragingly. Joe chuckled. "Yeah, it's good for speaking," he allowed, "but I can't hold a tune with it, and Dawn sounds like she's been gargling gravel. The harmonies you and your bandmates get..." He shook his head. "Well, it's magic to me. I just wanted to tell you that." Thank you, said Kate, blushing a little. I think you're... She nudged Mickey and made a brief gesture. Mickey smiled. "Your songs have a lot of subtle complexity to them. You really have to listen to realize how intricate they really are. And a lot of that depends on the performance to bring it out. We both think that's remarkable." "Oh, I'm Mickey Kaworu, by the way," he said, offering a hand. "Joe Groff," Joe replied, shaking it. "I didn't see you last fall. Are you new in the band?" Kate grinned. Not yet, she said. Mickey elaborated. "I just started at WPI after Christmas time. I'm Caitlin's deputy student conductor with the Institute Orchestra, but I haven't joined the Art of Noise on stage. Sometimes I run the panel." "You guys do classical work, too?" Joe asked, raising his eyebrows. "That's awesome. I always wanted to do that. I've got some classical training, but I don't play a symphonic instrument. Well, I played some cornet in junior high, but I gave it up to focus on the guitar. Now I kind of regret it." "You can probably pick it up again more easily than you think," Mickey told him. "My sister gave up the piano when we were small, but she's just recently started practicing again, and she's coming along very fast." You have a lot of talent, that's obvious from your playing, and do you write the songs too?
Me and Jill, and sometimes Dom, he said. Jill's our drummer, Don plays bass. Eric's our rhythm guitarist, but he doesn't read music, just plays the fills by ear. He's so good at anticipating us, though, it's like he's got a telepathic power. He doesn't, of course. If he did, the freaking chorus wouldn't let him be in a band.
Kate nodded a little sadly.
Hmm, she said.
Please tell them for me that they're all very talented. I'm really enjoying the show.
Thanks, said Joe with that same ready grin.
I'll do that. Say, you want to get some dinner or something afterward with us? The band that's on after us is Mechano-Industrial Sklunge, not our speed, so we were planning on taking off. I know this nice little place in Chinatown. Tacky as hell, but you can't beat the food.
Kate and Mickey shared a brief private smile.
We'd love to, she said, but
there are three of us, Mickey noted. Dorothy's around here somewhere.
Oh, no problem, said Joe, swigging down the last of his beer. Bring as many as you like, they'll fit us in. I don't suppose the rest of the band is with you?
Not this trip, said Kate.
Too bad. I'd like to meet him, said Joe. So do the guys. Jill really wants to compare notes with your drummer. That double pedal technique he had for the old Ministry cover you guys pulled out blew her mind.
Demetrios took Joe's empty beer bottle and tapped his watch, smiling. Yep, said Joe, rising from his stool. Time to make some more donuts.
See you guys after the show, huh?
See you, said Kate, waving, as he plunged off into the crowd toward the stage again. Then she turned to Mickey, grinning.
Wow, he's cool.
Mickey nodded. Seems like quite a nice guy, he agreed.
So there's been a Chernov at every Leafs game since this guy, said Roy, turning to show the name on the back of his sweater, was an active goalie.
Utman made a mental note to look up the playing years of Leafs goalies named Pommetier, and in the meantime gave an outraged yowl as the ref made a hooking call on Karen Torborg, not because the call was bad, but because Torborg had only hooked in retaliation for a vicious cross-check that the ref had somehow failed to notice.
What are you, blind? Roy Chernov bellowed.
Apparently so, Sionji concurred. Utna glanced at him and snickered. He had that pinched-faced little pupils look that had always heralded either big trouble or major unwitting comedy from Vice President Sionji back in the bad old days. Seeing that look in this context, the young man staring with that vicious laser-like focus at a referee separated from him by 100 feet and a half inch of plaster struck her as pretty funny.